This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because of the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello, this is Elaine Scott, and this is Birth to Work Radio. Welcome. Tonight's show is a discussion about city leaders, about stakeholder leaders, and about the significant and important role that they play in the development of communities today. My guest tonight is Hal Malkin, along with my co-host, Rick Stevens. Our discussion tonight is going to focus on the whole world of being part of a community leadership process, of which Hal is one of my definitive people. He does it better than anybody I know. Currently serving as the mayor pro tem of the city of La Mirada in one of his stakeholder roles, Hal was first elected to the La Mirada City Council in 1994 and has been subsequently reelected like three times. Wow, Hal, that's great. He served as mayor, chairman of the Redevelopment Agency from 1998-99. He's a member of the La Mirada Theater Commission for 17 years, involved in civic organizations, and has all kinds of roles, including past president of the La Mirada Chamber of Commerce, Friends of the Library, Angels for the Friends of the La Mirada Theater, all sorts of roles that are about a person who has taken a definite stand in the development of his community. But more than anything, Hal is also interested in education, he's interested in his family, and he's interested in a sustainable vision for La Mirada. And we want to talk something about that tonight. What I'm going to ask you to start with, Hal, is to talk to our listeners a little bit about the whole idea of what it means to be a stakeholder in a community.
Okay, well, first of all, we're a mid-sized community. Our population just burst through the magic number of 50,000. And in California, that's a significant number because at 50,000, we officially become a medium-sized community. Up until 2 years ago, we were considered small. So now we're officially middle-sized or medium-sized community. And because of that, we are eligible for other certain federal monies and state monies that aren't eligible to smaller cities. But more importantly, we're a city that believes, has huge sense of community. We put a lot of value into all aspects of what it means to be a member of our society, especially in our little city. It's, of course, as a city, the way I got into the city council is sort of interesting, is I owned a business in the city. It was a drugstore. And many people, in fact, say that the reason I got onto the city council was because of all the knowledge I have about their medical histories. It's not true. I never used any of it. That's all confidential. But it was the fact that I had a lot of, we were the major drugstore for the city of La Mirada, and people came in, as you did. And
I'm
not going to reveal anything about your medical history, but you were a customer, and that's how we first met. And then over the counter is a great place to talk, and that's the reason I bring that up. That's sort of symbolic of what La Mirada is like. It's the old town community where we didn't have a fountain, but the old time drugstore used to have a fountain, and that's where people would talk about community events. Well, in my drugstore, the pharmacy counter was the counter where people talked. And I would hear what people had to say about our community, what the good things were and what the bad things were. And people, now, of course, you didn't live in La Mirada proper, but you shopped in La Mirada, which we appreciated since we got the sales tax money from you, which is our lifeblood, of course. And so in that process, I became very involved in the community. And then when they were going to build a true performing arts theater, it was my opportunity to get involved, and one of the council members asked me if I'd serve on the committee, and that's sort of the beginning. The
notion of how many of those activities in the city you were involved in terms of getting started were critical, but I wanted to bring up the notion of community and sort of if we were anthropologists talking about it, we'd say a community is actually about 150 people. And so when you bring us out and help us understand the growth of community to all those different sizes, it helps us understand that community is not only just the people in our neighborhoods, but all the people that surround, that are in the surrounding area. I think
Absolutely.
That's an important consideration.
If I were, I could not, as a city council member or even as a business person in the community, survive on just the La Mirada residents. You can't. And even as a city, as a businessman, of course, I needed the entire area around me. But as a city of La Mirada, we are dependent upon all the communities around us. But that is also, there's a problem that becomes inherent in that. And the problem is that as a city council, we sometimes become very territorial. We sort of say, this is my territory, you stay out of here. And in fact, tonight, interestingly enough, on this Tuesday that we're talking, we're going to be having a hearing about the KFI tower that's going to be built on a piece of property in La Mirada. It was knocked down by an aircraft. And the city of Fullerton is saying, oh, you can't do that because it's going to be in the way of the airport. And they're saying, you're stepping on our territory. And we're saying, no, you're stepping on our territory. And this territorialness, I think, is one of the biggest obstacles that we face today in talking about community.
And so, Hal, this is Rick. And,
Rick.
Thinking about 23 years ago when you started, you know, and you bring up this notion of territorial issues, what was it like 23 years ago versus, and the challenges you faced then from a territory standpoint, versus where you see it today? Is it people have changed? Is it greater information availability? Or is it about this greater interdependence of what it really means to be in a community and who all the stakeholders are?
I think you hit it on the latter part. I think we're starting to realize that we are not insular in our actions or in the things that happen to us. The word's being overused, but I think it's very applicable. We are becoming more global. And I don't necessarily mean in the sense of worldwide globalization. Our city is much too small to be concerned about that. But I have to start thinking globally in the sense of my region that I'm in. For years, La Mirada didn't participate. Well, years and years and years ago we did because it was sort of a perk. You got to go to these little conventions and stuff that were all over the country, and you acted like you really cared. It wasn't that they really didn't care, but it didn't affect us. It was beyond our scope. But today, all the cities around me, meaning the city of La Mirada, they have an impact on what happens in my city. And now we're starting to realize that. So we're becoming more global in our thinking. Again, our global thinking is going to be very small. But as a community, we have to realize that what we do affects the cities around us, and what they do affects us.
So from a utility standpoint, from a road standpoint, from people moving in and out, from an employment standpoint, you know, all of the elements that you run into, certainly the complexity of cities, talk a little bit about the complexity internal to La Mirada and the relationships that are now so critically important between, you know, business and media and government, you know, and education and healthcare and, you know, community organizations and how it's impacted you and the implications.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, let's start with education. And first thing I want to do is, you know, one of the things that if you read the newspapers and you listen to the media, they blame education for everything, and it's not to be blamed for everything. It's part of the problem. By the way, it's also potentially a big part of the solution, but it is not the problem or the solution. But in the sense of a city working with the school district, again, territorial imperative shows up so strongly in those situations. The schools have been defined, the school district or the schools themselves have been defined as little islands within our community. And they have their own board of trustees, which is like a city council for a city. They govern what goes on in the school premises. They determine who's going to be able to come onto campus, who cannot come onto campus. They say that what happens there stays there, much like the little Vegas slogan that's going out that you hear now. and that no matter what you think, city, you can't come in here and influence us. And yet, we as a city say, no, what's going on? First of all, those are the children of the residents of our community that are there for the most part. There are some that come in from outside the community. But for the most part, they're residents of our community, and we have to know what's going on that campus. But they, meaning the administrators of the school district, the board of trustees and the superintendent, et cetera, say, no, if we give in to you, then you're going to have power over us that we don't. And we don't want that power. It's not a matter of power. It's a matter of knowledge. And I think that you used the word knowledge in your little statement that you said. I think what we're happening is we're learning that without information, you cannot function properly.
Let's hold that thought for just a minute. I want to come back to this after our break. We have an interesting follow-up question that has to do with the potential role of collaboration and building alliances and the value of that for helping our kids get ready for the workforce of the future, since we clearly want to be able to hire the kids that graduate from the schools. This is Birth to Work Radio, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Elaine Scott again with Hal Malkin and Rick Stevens, and we're talking about the relationship between the power structures in communities that people assume probably work together, but in fact often don't, and that's the city council, for example, working with the local schools, working with, as Rick said earlier, the health communities. But there's also, working together is one thing, but having real jurisdiction to collaborate and make things happen is another. And Hal, I know you've got an excellent example of a collaborative, so what I'm going to call, and what we like to call in Birth to Work, a proactive action. That was one that was a little testy and a little tough to get off the ground, but has to do with the police force. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, years ago, first of all, La Mirada is a contract city, and we use the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department as our police force. So when I refer to it our police, it'll actually be the Sheriff's Department. And years and years and years ago, on the camp, the high school campus, in order to just gather information about what was going on the campus, we shared the cost of a police officer on that campus. He worked for about 2 hours a day, was on the campus, and just gathered information, talked with the kids, and by being there, the presence gave a sense of safety.
Okay, just a quick question. Do most schools usually have a police officer?
No, that in itself is a little bit strange, although since Columbine, you're seeing more and more now. It's becoming almost a method of giving a sense of safety to both the students and the parents of those students to see an officer there. You're seeing more and more of it now.
Okay, so this is in lieu of having metal checks and...
Oh, yeah, and metal checks, though. I mean, you've got to... It's a very fine line that you have between trying to make people feel safe and make them feel scared.
Okay.
Metal checks make you feel scared. An officer walking around the campus makes you feel safe.
I just wondered. Yeah. I didn't recall how many schools are doing that. Okay,
yeah, it's becoming more and more prevalent, especially in the California area.
Okay.
So what happened was, because of budget crisis, et cetera, the school district decided that they would not pay for half of the sheriff's department, and half the officer, rather, to be on campus. And we got into a little bit of a discussion with them, and it wasn't a nice, pleasant discussion. And we just said, okay, then forget it. We won't do it either. About 5 years went by, and we said, you know, this is really crazy. We have lost the ability to gain knowledge about what's happening with our youth, especially in the area of gang enforcement and just what generally is going on. The truancy rate started to climb, and we said, we've got a little problem here. So rather than just say, let's go back and split the cost, we told the school district, we are placing an officer on your campus, and there are certain ways you can sort of force that issue as a public safety issue. So we took it under our umbrella of public safety and said, we want to put an officer there. They accepted that. They didn't have much choice anyways. And immediately, the whole tenor of the school changed. It became much more safe. The gang activity dropped. Truancy levels dropped. the school has gotten quite a bit larger now, so we asked if we could put another officer on there. And this time, because they felt very, let's say, embarrassed by what we had done, they offered to pay half. So we sort of shamed them into a 50-50 for the second officer. And we would have paid for the full officer, the second one, but they felt that they had to. They realized the benefit of it. It was us, the city, taking a proactive approach to the problem. Wasn't severe. I don't want to even imply that we had a huge gang problem or anything, but we were starting to develop.
So in other words, what you were doing was a proactive rather than a reactive
thing. Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's happened since, and to show you the effect of this, the API scores, which we in California, it's our the way they rate schools, have gone up tremendously. There's a whole new atmosphere on that campus of they're not under the stress levels of gangs and fights and stuff like that. They haven't had a fight on that campus in almost 2 years now. Why? Because there are two officers walking around. They know they're going to get nabbed. Drug use has dropped, almost to zero on the campus. I'm not saying the community, but on the campus.
Well, let me give the listeners a little bit of a corollary to that. As a pharmacy tech and a practitioner, one of the things that I remember very clearly about doing business with you, that in your business, you had the same attitude. There was a consistency between the way you lead and the way you did your business. And in your business, whenever I would come in for things for my girls, you would always first either A, ask me if I had tried such and such, which was a very natural process. Then you would ask me if I had tried anything over the counter. Then you would inquire about anything that had to do with a pharmaceutical product.
Right.
And I remember that very clearly because we spent a lot of time talking about our kids, yours who were both homeschooled, mine partially homeschooled. And that whole notion of being accountable and responsible on a parental level, on a business level, and now it rolls over and it shows up in your work as a stakeholder, which I think
right.
is extremely
And my goal
important.
As a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. You see, I have to emulate what I want them to do. And that's the only way it can happen is by me doing. You mentioned how many things I'm involved in. Well, I am. But does it become tiresome? Absolutely. Is it tough to go to all these meetings? Absolutely. But if I don't do it, who's going to show these people what it does? You can always use the excuse, I'm too busy. Well, I'm a professor at the college. This semester I'm teaching 7 classes. I'm involved with the union at the school. I have so many hats on, and yet you still have to lead by example. That's always been my campaign slogan, and it will be my lifestyle. Lead by example.
Hal, a lot of what we talk about and what people see from a community leadership standpoint, community engagement, is everyone's motivated, and so we use the term motivated expectations in language. A lot of people are motivated, to go do the right thing. And they have the same expectations. They want to live in a community that's safe, that's engaging, that's involved, that's educated students. It's got a great lifestyle. And the challenge they get around, though, is what does it really mean to do all of those things and create that environment, or what we call language? It's the words people use. It's the measurements that they use. It's how you really reflect what it is we're trying to have to this end state of the community. And again, I go back to 23 years ago, from a leadership standpoint, probably a lot easier to get people involved and engaged because you could get everyone together in a room and talk about, here's the vision for La Mirada, and as you would go out and garner votes and prepare for the elections, everyone could see that vision.
Right.
Today, there's a lot more information out there where, lots of people have different perspectives, email. Probably not. The meetings may not be as well attended as they used to be, and even information about what goes on in the community is probably harder to get to be able to use. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing, particularly about community leaders? Are they ready to go do this? Not. What do you think is holding other leaders back from taking a very similar stance about getting out, engaging, and being involved? Do you have any insights or thoughts there?
I do, and I think one of the problems you have is On a lot of the boards that govern, whether they be in the form of governing business, meaning the boards of directors, or in the city, in the case of my cities, the cities that I'm familiar with, there seems to be competition for attention. They don't work together as a team, and I know that's old trite stuff, that there's no I in team and all that kind of stuff, but if you look at a lot of the city councils, you have they're divisive. They're divisive among themselves. You have you see 3-2 votes all the time. You see one side calling the other side names, and then they start talking about other cities, or they start talking about the school board. This is not good. You can't denigrate the other side and expect them to respond back in a nice way. Same thing about when city councils, when people come before them to speak. Many times they're put down, and they're treated as if that what they say has no value. To me, the citizens are the ones that's why we're there. We're there because these citizens. There would be no need for us if everybody were happy and go like you know in a utopian type situation. We're there because people want us to come up with visions for them. Our role on the city council isn't to hire and fire the employees. I don't even know 3/4 of the employees' names, to be very honest. It's not my job. We only hire and fire one person, the city manager. But what we do is we set visions. And I think that that's become a major problem in that you don't have a cohesiveness of vision among the leaders.
Well, I want to follow up on something you just said that I think has always troubled me for a long time, and it has to do with the idea of consistency of message. And I'm talking about parents with consistency of message, schools with consistency of message, cities with consistency of message. One of them has to do with this, and it's a very minor example, but it's an example of how we send mixed messages. And we tell kids, for example, you know, not to drink. And yet you don't see an adult party and in many, many cases where adults even support kids to go drink.
Absolutely.
And we tell people, don't drive fast. You know, watch out for driving fast. And yet there's a proliferation of all these little devices on that people can buy for their cars, you know, to drive and then not be caught by the police. And yet the first person you would call if you were in trouble would be the police. And we had,
right.
So we were sending out mixed messages there. And then we don't fight, you know, don't hurt and talk things through. And yet you have a little boy in Florida who's dismissed for sexual harassment for kissing a little girl. And then
he didn't even kiss her. He hugged her.
He hugged her. Is that
he
right?
Hugged her.
And then
yeah,
down,
he
and then down
her.
The street, there's a video parlor where he can go and practice chopping people's heads off.
Right.
And so we send mixed messages all the way around, and there's no consistency. There's less and less consistency between the standards and the behaviors that we're looking for and the expectations that we have. And again, the language is very confusing. Do you ever find yourself, I'm gonna circle back to when we first, one of the times when we worked together for the social services, or I was working with social services, and you came and observed one of my classes, and you commented on how I was teaching people how to behave. I was really much more concerned with their behavior than I was with teaching them facts or data or pieces of information, because it was the behavior that was the problem. And I think that that particular issue for me is what you model, and you are consistent now with that same modeling process in your role as a having built one of the finest pharmacy tech programs, I think, in the country.
Thank you.
At Cerritos College, having come only from having been a pharmacy tech and running your own business, and not having been a college professor. So my point in this whole thing is consistency of attitude and performance and modeling begins very, very early.
Well, I believe very firmly that I can teach all the skills, the hard skills. I can teach them to count 5 pills at a time. I can teach them to pick the right medicine up. What I think we have to teach and model are what we call the soft skills. The soft skills that you just talked about, the fact that you do not cuss out your employer, that you show up to time, show up to work on time. These are the skills that employers are going to be looking for. Almost every business can teach the internal skills they need. It's getting that person to work on time.
I think that when you and I first talked and you were commenting that one of the things that you were interested in what I was doing with my social services people was just exactly that.
Yes.
That I had focused on teaching them the kinds of things that were required.
How to dress.
How to say to their employer what you just said I didn't understand.
Exactly.
And how to use eye contact and that sort of thing. So I think all those things are all part of that part of that soft skills message, and we want to come back around and we want to discuss a little bit more about that whole idea of the problems of education as they relate to what kids really need on a community basis to go out and get jobs. And this is Birth to Work Radio. We're talking to Hal Malkin and Rick Stevens, and we'll be right back.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birth2work.org or amazon.com.
This is Elaine Scott, and I'm back again with my guest today, Hal Malkin, and co-host Rick Stevens. We're talking about education and collaboration between education and stakeholder leaders, community leaders. And one of the things that we were addressing was the need to build a more collaborative environment between all the community leaders who are known as stakeholders who influence the development of programs and the relationships that help give direction to citizens and especially to students as they are in school taking classes. And Hal, I know you've had a significant influence in that area in La Mirada in a health area. And so if you would talk to us a little bit about some of the integrative models that you've created, that would be incredible.
Yeah, well, as far as the city goes, we recently, about 3 years ago, opened up what's called a resource center. And in that resource center, we specifically set aside areas for students after school to come into the resource center and have an area set up with a complete computer lab. And we thought a few people would use it because most students have computers at home. Well, that model happens to be not really true, even though a lot of students do have computers at home. There are a lot that don't. And so we set up the computer lab with the idea that they could come and use it because the libraries were so impacted that you could never get on there, especially by adults. And
how did you know that?
How did we know about the library?
Uh-huh.
Oh, we went overlooked. And actually, it was the daughter of our city manager went over to use it one day and couldn't use it. They there were adults on it, and they specifically said, well, there's no room for you to use the computer. And she said, but I have to do a research report. And they told her, no, there's no room. And so that started the whole conversation of what are these students doing? The school could not open up the lab after school hours because they didn't have anybody to run it. And again, the schools are impacted financially. I'm not even making any denials of that. So we built this lab with 35 computers in there, and immediately it was full. And so we said, well, that's the sort of an indication of how much need there is. So we set up this thing where we have a homework club where we bring in tutors. We actually, as a city, pay the tutors to be there to help the students do their projects. Well, my God, you would think that it was the second coming. They are so excited about what's occurring there. And the school now actually has set up, as part of their curriculum, to use that homework lab because they saw what value it had. We took a problem that we didn't even know they had the problem at the school, but their computers are down half the time. The kids can't even get on them. So they are using our lab, and again, does it cost us money? Absolutely. Do we see a value in it? Absolutely. While the kids are in there, of course, they're in a city, piece of city property. They're taught to respect that property. And then we actually, a lot of conversation takes place between those tutors and the students where we're learning about what's going on in their lives. And they're not acting as spies, believe me. That's not one of the things. But if we hear about a situation where a family's in need, we have many free social services in our community. We have a Straight Talk is the one that handles it for us, where if a child is having abuse problems, or a young lady or a young male is having abuse problems, we can actually recommend that they go there and stuff like that. And that, by the way, as a city council member, I never hear any of the cases particularly. I want you to know this is all kept very confidential. Okay, it's between the students and the Straight Talk. So,
but I think what you're walking through, Hal, is you're walking through a community that everyone wants to live in. That when you do that, you end up bringing together school, you bring together community, you bring together social services, you bring together counselors, and you brought all those services together so that's really the sorts of communities we want to live in.
Absolutely. And the one thing that we're doing is by talking to one another, we realize that even though we're using the same words, we had no clue what those meanings were. When we would use a word, we thought it meant this. Social services thought it meant this. The school thought it meant this. And then we realized we're using the same words but not even talking to one another. So one of the first things we had to do was sit down and say, when we talk about abuse, what are you talking about? Because as a pharmacy tech, abuse to me means a completely separate thing than it does when you talk about a social service person. Social service person views it as person on person. I see it as a drug problem. And so once we started to get this common vocabulary, my goodness, doors opened up and windows opened up where we started to look into one another's environment, and we saw things that we never even realized existed. But what we realized was that the ones that were suffering through this whole process were the adults were doing one thing and the kids were suffering.
Yeah.
Now the kids are being made part of the process. We set up a youth council that consists of one representative from every school, two representatives from the whole homeschooling, and when I say every school, by the way, we include the parochial schools in our whole process. A large number of La Mirada students go to parochial schools. So we didn't want to exclude them from this process, and they're in that process. Well, now we've got this whole communication taking place where we understand now what these students are facing. They're coming to us. They said they needed some place to socialize, that they didn't have a comfortable place to socialize. We opened up another part of this resource building and called it the basement. It has, those foosball games. It's got those arcade games. But the kids just go down there and talk. And again, we have people there that can help them through if they're having a situation.
And you need to report the real coup de grace for the whole thing. The real cherry on the top is that La Mirada is listed as what, the safest or one of the safest?
We are by the FBI statistics, we are the safest city in the 50,000 to 100,000 range in Southern California, the safest. And if I can really plug CNN. On there, this was released just about 3 months ago, listed us as the 34th best livable place in the United States of America.
That is terrific, and I think a real testament to the value
of
people working together, aligning and thinking about how to pull together, and some great examples from a leadership standpoint. And let me pull on that thread a little bit more. How you talked about pulling some councils together, you pulled, I'll call them stakeholder representatives from the schools,
mm-hmm.
From the various organizations together, to begin to develop common language, so everyone understood what a word meant. Were there some other techniques that our listeners might be able to take advantage of, what you learned along the way to develop this common language and data and what you're really seeing so everyone sees the same picture?
Yeah, I think one of the first things that we learned in the process was when you're talking with the other groups, don't be condescending to them. Don't think that you have the answers. We might have an answer, but it might not be the answer, that you have to listen to them. You also have to realize that lots of times they're afraid, as we were, to give up information. We sort of, there comes that territorial thing again. I know something you don't know, and I don't want you to know it. You have to be willing to, show your warts as well as your pretty things.
That was the issue with Simon Ramo, and when he was writing his book called The System, and he was talking about all kinds of problems in inventing the first credit card system, and how difficult that was to get off the ground because there wasn't a retailer in the world that wanted to give up their customer information.
Exactly.
But until they were willing to share information and put it in a third, you know, put it in an environment where it could be used, none of that could have happened.
No, and that's a classic, I mean, a great example, Elaine, of what we had to go through. It was everybody wanted to keep their information, and again, they would tell us the good things, but they wouldn't tell us the bad things, as we would never tell. We realized, hey, we've got problems. As a city, we know internally we have certain situations. Tell us what we can do to change them, to make them fit your model. So what we did was, it was, I think, that opening up. And Rick, you said, what did we learn? I think we learned that you have to have informal meetings. I know this sounds crazy, but you have to be able to get into a comfortable situation where you really feel you can talk openly without fear of retribution, that this is going to come back and haunt you later.
So Hal, maybe it's a good time to take a break right now, and after the break we'll come back and continue that thought as we help our community leaders to think about what's it really mean to be a community leader and preparing for the future to be a leader going forward in this future environment. This is Birth to Work Radio. We'll be back in a few moments. And this is Rick Stadens with Birth to Work Radio, here with my partner Elaine Scott and Hal Malcolm, a city councilman for the city of La Mirada. Hal, as you think about going forward and transitioning to, you know, future leaders, you know, what are you doing as a city council member to prepare the leadership for the future, and what are some of the recommendations you could give to our audience as you think about the challenges you face in this area?
Actually, it's interesting that you talk about. In the next 3 years, three of our council members will be leaving. One of them will be leaving next year, and then 2 years later, the councilman that I got elected with, Pete Dames, will be leaving. So we're both going to be, I'm in my last term, by choice. And we've been concerned about who is going to replace us because we didn't see any leaders out there. So for the last 3 years, we have actually been looking into who can come up. And one of the worries we had was there didn't seem to be anybody that was just going to pop out of the water. You have your gadflies, of course, that are always going to want to run, but that really are not leaders in the sense of true leadership. So we started to look into our commissions. We have several commissions. We have an athletic commission. We have a senior commission. We have a historical commission. And we started to talk to people and said, would you consider going on to the city council? Not anointing them, just asking them. And then we started to actually have little meetings and seminars where we started to let the people know what does it take to be a leader. And we've taken all of our commissions, and every year now all members of the commissions meet in together with the city council, and we tell them this is what it takes to be a city council member. And they see us, and they go through, and we talk about what a day is like, what a week is like, what a month is like, and what a year is like with us. Suddenly, we have about 10 people now that are young. When I say young, they're adults, they're not and not children by any sense, but young in the sense that they're in their 20s and 30s that are stepping forward, and that is very young to step forward as a city council member in the city of La Mirada. Traditionally, we've been in the 50s and 60s when they start. So we are excited because we're seeing some young people who will then be able to serve long terms. I mentioned to you, Rick, during the break that the average term for a La Mirada City Council member is 17 years. The average term, 17 years.
Yeah, so that's lots of longevity.
Oh, that's lots of longevity. But
well,
what does that give you? It gives you consistency.
Well, consistency and the opportunity to develop language, common understanding, you know, and how to move that forward. Just to help on language, you mentioned the term commission as kind of what I interpret as the feeder pool. What sort of commissions are these?
Well, they're either appointed by us or within their own structure. They can appoint one another. They're commissions that deal with specific subjects. They are the intermediary between the public and the council. If a lot of people are afraid to come to city council, they're just afraid, so they go to these commission meetings. We have a public safety commission where you can go in and you can say, we think we need a stop sign here or a stop light there, or people are speeding. We have a senior commission where seniors can go in and talk to other seniors about what concerns them. We have the youth commission where other youth can come and talk what's concerning them, and then they give us feedback. They feed information to us.
So in essence, you're building the feeder pool, and you're mentoring that feeder pool, and they get to see the real modeling in action about
Absolutely.
What it takes not only to be a leader in the city and all the dynamics associated with that, but how to work together, how to develop common language, so these transitions ought to be relatively smooth.
Absolutely, and that's what we're finding. Once a year, we have this program called Youth in Government, where students actually elect from the high school, elect five city council members, and then the other members become, they have a city manager, they have the police chief, the fire chief, and all these, and they come and they actually shadow us for 1 month. For 1 month, they shadow us. And then there's this meeting, a regular city council meeting where the city council members are on the dais sitting right next to us, and all of the other staff employees, the city manager, the city attorney, each have their person sitting next to them, just like we do. They then run a city council, and they actually bring forth propositions. We have a $5.5 million gym that was built in this community based on the fact that the youth council decided it was a good idea. And then the real city council, us, the next 2 months later, approved what they came up with. And that's how you mentor leadership, by letting them do it.
I think what's very important here, Hal, I go back to kind of where we were in the beginning of our conversation, with the consistency in performance, in attitude, in behavior, in language, because you have two sons. I mean, I know that you, we talked often about the boys when they were growing up and how you homeschool them and put them in high school at the appropriate age. And I believe now both of them, one has his PhD and the other's on his way to getting his PhD.
He'll get it in May, yeah.
But they were also outstanding participants in the life of the community and in the schools where they went.
Absolutely.
And then you brought that same model, that same determination to be inclusive, and always a model of excellence and honoring people and looking out for them. And I think those are things that we want to talk to stakeholders about.
You know, it's trite to say, but the future is based on our kids. How we model to them is going to determine where this country goes. And if you say A and do B, I think you're doing a great disservice to them because you're putting confusion into their life. One time we were talking about fear, that what is it like, you know, and you and Elaine and I think, Rick, you were in part of the conversation when we were talking about the so-called illegal alien problem.
Yes.
Where what does it mean? We try to put a lot of blame for some of our problems onto this illegal alien problem. But imagine a life where you have to look over your shoulder every minute of every day, wondering if you're going to be taken away and moved out of your life as you know it. And imagine a family that has that situation. Then children who are here legitimately, they were born in this country and they are citizens of this country, worried about their parents. I think we have to get rid of this this feeling of fear that so many, and it's not just the illegal aliens, by the way. It's pervasive in our community. There's a sense of fear that I don't feel is good for our community. I think if we can deliver as leaders a vision and hope and actually model it, I think that's where we're going to move this country forward. We're not going to do it by putting fear into everybody. And if you look at what the political scene today, it's based on fear, and yet what message is winning the elections? I mean, I'm just, while being online, during the breaks I went on and looked at New Hampshire. Who's leading that right now? It's leading where the word is change and hope.
Hope. Well, you are definitely a model of that. I can't quite express just how grateful we are to have had you be with us today. You are a personification of the notion of the stakeholder, leader in a community, the person who not only lives it, but teaches it, models it, and prepares a way forward for the future. La Mirada has always been blessed to have you. I'm blessed to be able to call you a friend, and we look forward to having you come back and talk to us again. But this time we want to talk about mentoring other communities and other people from different stakeholder groups who want to learn more about what you're doing. We missed the opportunity to talk about that great clinic you're building, so we want to come back and bring that up.
Absolutely. And again, thank you for what you two are doing. You're taking the and moving us forward into at a time that I think we're going to need it more than ever to survive as a great, great country and nation.
Well, you did a great job of putting on the table the things that we talk about in our book, The System Seeking the Soul of Commerce. La Mirada is a living, breathing example of the best that can happen when community stakeholders work together. Thank you, Rick. Glad you were here today. And Rick and Hal, and we'll look forward to seeing everybody again at our next broadcast. This is Birth to Work Radio. This is Elaine Scott.
And Rick Stevens.
And we'll see you again next time.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.